My name's Sydney, I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for inviting me, Lisa, and the ILAA. It's really nice to be here. It's really nice not to be handcuffed to a chair in the Carson City, Nevada Police Department, which is what happened the last time I drank vodka in the morning. So, you know, every time I get up here, I get really nervous. And my sponsor likes to say that's self-centered fear, which is what it is. But years ago, I have three kids. They're now 15, 21, and 23. But years ago, I was going to speak, and I told my youngest daughter, I'm really nervous. And she goes, well, what do you talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, well, my life. And she goes, well, how hard could that be? It's not like you don't know the story. And then I said, sometimes we read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, oh, so it's like a book club, only you read the same book over and over and over. I said, yeah. So I have to say, I'm a little bit distracted because last night after dinner, I got this call from my 23-year-old daughter, and she's like in tears. I can't even understand what she's saying. And this girl is not drama at all. She's the most even-keeled person. And she's totaled my car. And so you know what? Because of this program, the first thing I said is, are you okay? And is the person that you hit okay? Which they are. Everybody's okay. When what I really wanted to say and what I would have said in the past was, oh my God, what is wrong with you? How can you wreck my car? Don't you know we're in no financial situation to get a new car? Da, 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 da. And I thought, you know, this program is amazing. It's like it slowly kind of seeps in and grabs a hold of you, and you know what to do. I drank and used drugs for 30 years. The first 15 years was more devoted to drugs, but there was alcohol the entire 30 years. My sobriety date is February 19th, 2004. I was born in Columbus, Georgia, and I was raised in Ponca City, Oklahoma, which is a small town on the border of Kansas. It's an oil, gas, and farming town. It's where Conoco Oil started many years ago. I'm the oldest of four children, and there's no alcoholics anywhere in my family, which, you know, my family's like so proud of me. And, you know, I used to tell them, you know, it's not me. This is not me. This is God's grace and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day my dad and my brother were talking, and I was there, and my dad said, I got to get to the bottom of this. Is this hereditary, or was it a result of your environment? And my brother looks at him and goes, either way, Dad, you're screwed. And my brother, who's 3 years younger than me, you know, he did all the shenanigans I did in high school, only he didn't become an alcoholic. And he still has a resentment towards my parents for, like, not stopping this. And I said, well, you know what, I'm the one that grew up to be the alcoholic, and you grew up and you grew out of it. Why? I don't have a resentment. Why do you still have a resentment? What were they going to do? Why don't you kids stop what you're doing? Okay, we'll stop. But I always felt different, and what I've come to know from the book, it was that feeling of restless, irritable, and discontent from as long as I can remember. And I pulled out a picture the other day, one of those family portrait deals, of the four children, and my daughter was like, oh my God, because no wonder you felt different, because there I am, I had this massive amount of black hair, and I'm dark-skinned, and then there's these three cherubic little blonde-haired, blue-eyed children, and the people when I was growing up, they'd pull my mother aside, and they're like, where'd she come from? Mailman? And so before I ever started drinking, that lying and stealing kind of took a hold. And I can remember when I was in, like, I was thinking about these stories. And when I was 6 years old, we lived in a development in this small town where they were building new houses. So every night after dinner, I'd go out with my friends, and we'd start kicking the houses in, go inside of them, and just, like, kick them in with our little, you know, you're like this tall. And one day my mother said to me, have you seen any bad men roaming around the neighborhood? And I'm thinking, no, it's my posse of six-year-old friends that are kicking these houses in. And, you know, my mother, she was kind of ahead of her time. She was really into health food and all that. And I was probably the only one in that entire grade school that had to go to school with brown bread sandwiches. Do you know how demoralizing that is when all you want is white bread and no cookies? And you could buy the cookies at school. So those kids would set their money out on their desk, and I wanted a cookie. So I would go by and steal that money off their desk. And one day, the principal came in and he decided he was going to search all the desks. And I put the newspaper over it because by then I had acquired quite a lot of money. But you know, it just starts so early. And I used to talk about how I had my first drink when I was in eighth grade, which was sloe gin and cherry 7-Up. But really, I had my first drink before that because I used to get these coughs, and we would go to the country doctor, and she didn't believe in cough medicine. So what she told my mom is you need to get whiskey and, you'd make this tea, whiskey and lemon and hot water. And so we're at this camping site one night, and I got the cough, and we go to the little corner store. It was in Arkansas. And she said, my mother didn't drink, and she said, I want the cheapest whiskey you have. And the guy behind the counter's like, okay. And she goes, oh, it's not for me, it's for her. And I'm like, he's like, yeah, right, lady. but I always wanted to be somewhere else. And I used to always watch the clock, and like, I just wanted it to be, like, I quit wearing a watch, because maybe that would help, quit watching the clock. And you know that Monkees song? There used to be a television show, The Monkees, the group, and they would say at the end that, hey, hey, we're the Monkees, we might be coming to your town. And I was like, please, come to Ponca City and help me get out of here. Just from that young age, I wanted to be something else and somewhere else. So in high school, So I always did really well in school, and I had a job, and you know, I played the clarinet and all that stuff, but I also liked to hang out with these 25-year-old men, and my parents didn't really like that, and I could not understand, you know, I'm 16, why don't you want me hanging out with these 25-year-old men? Or I had a job one summer with these, I think they were like grifters, painting houses, and at noon we'd get in the car, the pickup truck, and go to the other small town and drink at noon at the bars. And my brother had the nerve to tell on me, and my parents were concerned. And I'm like, what? What's the matter with you? But I was always like depressed, and so my parents would take me, oh, we went to Dallas to see the child psychologist and the school psychologist, and we'd go to Oklahoma City. And you know, by then I was doing the drugs too, and you know, you're not getting very far when you're high on horse tranquilizer. Or when you don't talk, when you don't go to the therapist. But I come from this like loving, caring family, and they didn't really know what to do with me. I didn't date too much in high school. I just really liked those drugs and that alcohol. But one day this boy asked me out, and he was really cute, and I was so excited. Oh my gosh. And so, you know, what we used to do in high school was we'd go out to the lake and drink. That was sort of our entertainment in this small town. So we go out to the lake, and he gets the chairs out and the cooler. And then he opens the cooler, and he's like, you want some yogurt? And I'm like, yogurt? Where's the beer? Yogurt had just been invented. And that was really, and I'm like, and then he invites me to the prom, and I'm like, I am not going to the prom with a yogurt boy. So when I was in high school, in Oklahoma back then, girls could drink when they were 18, and boys had to be 21. Now, this was just 3-2 alcohol, 3-2 beer, which some of you may not be familiar with. Beer usually is 6% alcohol. In Oklahoma, you could buy 3.2% beer. So the girls could. So that meant when you were really 16, you could buy beer because you could get away with it. So there was this case, Craig v. Boren, which many of you may have studied in law school. It's where the intermediate tier of the standard of review for the Equal Protection Clause came into play. It was the first, that was when the court looked at that and created that standard of scrutiny. And so it was this case where this boy sued because he said, that's not fair. That violates equal protection. That I have to be 21 and the girls can be 18. And I'm telling you what, once we got wind of that case, it did not take a rocket scientist or a con law major to realize that they were going to make it either 21 for both or 18 for both. And we were really, the girls were really nervous about that case. So I went to college, and I remember going, I went to my, the first year of college, I went to this small school called Coe College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I knew nobody, nobody. And I get up there, and I'm like, oh my God. And so we go to the football game, which I had no interest in going to, and they were all drinking peppermint schnapps. Now, I don't know if you drank peppermint schnapps, but it tastes like toothpaste. But, you know, it was like anything to get rid of that feeling. And then I transferred back down to the University of Oklahoma, which is, it was kind of like Animal Farm, or not Animal Farm, what's that? Anyway, there was just a lot of drinking. But I, you know, I could do well in school. So that was like the cover. If you can do well in school, probably like most of you here, then the outside world doesn't really notice what you're doing. The end of my, when I was in college, my fourth year, I was living with this guy, and he was from Philadelphia, and God bless him, I had met him in New Mexico at a summer camp, and he had moved with me to Oklahoma. He'd never even been to Oklahoma. So at the end of the year, he's like, where do you want to go? And I said, somewhere, anywhere. And he goes, well, I'm thinking about Boston or Berkeley. And I thought, well, I had never been to either one of those, so you pick. Now, can you imagine at this stage of your life saying you pick? So he picked Berkeley, and that's where we moved. And I was happy about that. I'm still in San Francisco. And he didn't last very long. But we get out there, and, you know, in Oklahoma, if you wanted to buy alcohol, you went to the liquor store. That was the only place you went. And I get to Berkeley, and I go to this, well, I didn't realize it was this, like, wine store. And I go in there, and I ask the proprietor, do you have Everclear? And he looks at me, and I'm like, yeah, you know, pure grain alcohol, PGA. And he's like, this is a wine store, and this is California. That is against the law. And I thought, well, how are we going to get this party started without some Everclear? And then we'd have these parties, and they'd spill out into the streets, and here'd come the Berkeley police, and once again. And we're like, what is the problem with these neighbors? You know, do they just not get it? And it would be like 6 o'clock in the evening and so loud you could shut the block down. So then I worked in Oakland. I worked at Legal Aid Society, what we used to call the home of wig shops and liquor stores, because back then Oakland was a really pretty dangerous town. And I worked there for a while as a paralegal, and I thought, well, I think I'm gonna go to law school. So I went to law school, I went to Georgetown. And even though I know that I was an alcoholic from the beginning, it was just a long, slow progression. And so when I was in law school, I was able to kind of, you know, keep it to the weekends or, you know, late at night and not drink all day yet. So one time, by then I had a different boyfriend, and he was living in Santa Barbara. So I come back to visit him in Santa Barbara, and I was staying with him, and the middle of the night, and all of a sudden he's yelling at me, and I'm like, what is the matter with you? And he's like, you're peeing in the corner of my bedroom. And I was like, oh, you know, it was just stuff like that you would, that I guess I would call that in a blackout. And then, you know, how you go on those interviews to get a summer associate job at those fancy law firms, and Those interviews would always take place in San Francisco, and I was staying in Berkeley for the summer, and they would just take so long. And so I one night I decided I'd have my friend come meet me, and she came a little bit early, and I was so drunk by the end of that dinner I could not even introduce her to all the people around the table who I was interviewing with, and I didn't get that job. Then after law school, I came back, and I lived in Los Angeles, and I worked for a federal district court judge for a year, and then I moved to San Francisco. I got married to the guy whose room I was peeing in his corner. God bless him, and we were married for a long time. And I used to have this bumper sticker on my car that said, if you can't go over the edge, why go? And then one year we decided, I worked at a big corporate law firm, and then I worked at Legal Services for Children, representing children. And before we had kids, we thought, well, we'll go on this trip to Thailand. So we went on this 3-week trip to Thailand, and part of the trip was you could go to the Bermuda Triangle and smoke opium. And I had done everything else, but I had not smoked opium. So boy, was I looking forward to that trip, that little piece of that trip. So finally, you know, we get up there and out, you know. So we get there, and it's like this thatched hut, and you climb up this rickety stairs, and you go in, and there's this old woman with no teeth and long gray hair, and there's no furniture. There's just a bamboo mat, and I don't know why, but you lay on your side to smoke this opium. And I'm, you know, so I'm really happy. And so this woman knows no English except for one word, and it's really the only word that you need to know. More? And then I had 3 children, and after the second one, I took an extended leave of absence, which unbeknownst to me was going to turn into a 14-year leave of absence from the practice of law to raise my kids. And I used to, when I would come to AA and I would hear these people talk about, I got sober before I had my kids and my kids have never seen me drink. And oh my God, that used to just chap me. I thought, what are you, bragging? I mean, really? God. And so I called my sponsor and to get, you know, to have her tell me what should I tell these people, because they really need to stop. And you know what she said to me? She goes, get over it and share about it, because that's not your experience. And that's not a lot of people's experience in the audience. So I was what you might call the drunk soccer mom. I did everything drunk. I took the carpool drunk. I went to the parent-teacher conference drunk. I went to the school plays drunk. I even went to Bible study drunk. Like one time, we were in this, you know, you got 3 kids, you got all these massive carpools. So I went to pick up this little girl to go to preschool, and the mom says, why are you here? And I'm thinking, well, is that a trick question? I come every morning, but I didn't say anything. But I did say, well, I'm here to pick up your daughter. And she goes, well, she's sick. And I go, oh, I must not have gotten the message. And she goes, no, we talked. And so it was like those cringe moments, or once my son, all of a sudden, I don't know what he was in, like 7th grade or something, he was gone from the house. And, you know, people steal children. And I went around to all the little shops in our neighborhood and looked and looked, and I couldn't find him, so I called the police. My son is missing. And then I sat down, and it occurred to me, oh, yeah, he's feeding the cat up the stairs, and he's up the street, and he loves this house because it's an only child, and this boy has all the bells and whistles that a little boy would love to play with, and that's where Logan is. So I called the police back to let them know I had located him, and they said, well, we still have to come out because he's a minor. And I'm like, oh, my God. And so by this time, Logan and his friend have come home, and the police are there to give them a big lecture about telling your mother where you are, and I'm wasted. And I thought, God, he should haul me away. Or once I went to school to pick him up, and you know how your face gets really red when you've been drinking for a prolonged amount of time? And I'm sitting in the hallway, or the foyer, waiting for the school to get out, and this friend of mine, Charlie, who's an ER doctor, comes by, and he goes, Sydney, your face is so red. And I'm like, who knew you could get a suntan in San Francisco? And he goes, it's been foggy for the last 2 months here. And, you know, so I don't wear makeup, but I went and got me some powder. So from then on, I had the red face filled with powder. And, you know, it just went on like that. I took those 3 kids on a road trip to Seattle for 2 weeks, listening to Harry Potter the entire way and drinking vodka. It's a miracle nothing happened. It truly is a miracle that nothing happened. Recently, a couple years ago, I was in Oklahoma, and I ran into a friend who I had grown up with in an AA meeting. And he's like, wow, I haven't seen you since you got married and all your friends stayed, all your law school friends stayed in my house. And that was 25 years ago. And so he came, we kind of rekindled a friendship, and he came out to visit me. So we're on the train in Noe Valley, which is where I live, and there's a little downtown area. And I'm like, oh, look, that was me. And it's this mom, the two little kids, and the stroller on 24th Street. And he goes, you think she has a bottle of vodka and some bottles of wine hidden under that stroller like you? And I'm like, probably not, Charlie. So this thing, it just went on. It was a long, slow progression. And on the outside, I had the three kids. I had the law degree. I probably would have been disbarred if I would have been practicing, the house, the husband, all that stuff. And on the inside, I was just dying. But it never occurred to me that it was alcohol. It never occurred to me. And I never tried to hide it. Well, I did try to hide it. I never tried to stop because it's what I did. It was like breathing. It's just what I did was drink. But one day, I get up, and it's Sunday morning, and my then husband and the three kids had gone to church. They went to church early to sing and practice for the choir, and then I would meet him. And I go into our home office, and I see this Smith, that was his last name, Smith family reunion coming up. And I'm like, well, I'm not clued into the Smith family reunion. And my mother and my sister and his sister and the children's minister and my neighbor, they were all on the invitation list, and it was my intervention. And coming up on Friday. So I got drunk and I went to church and, you know, I was just like a mess. But, and then that Monday, I got on the phone and I called the people that I needed to call, the lawyer, see what the, you know, what about those children? And I went to the homeopath, I went to the therapist that I had seen many years before. And they were all like, are you sure you're an alcoholic? But I had an appointment to get my hair cut with this guy that I'd gone to for many years. And he had always said in passing, and I don't know whether it was directed to me or just part of the story, that he was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know where to go. And I tell this story because you never know who you say something to that you're in AA, whose lives it may touch, even years later. So I happened to have a haircut appointment, and I told him, I said, Robert, I got a problem with alcohol. So he took me in that back room where they do the waxing and all this stuff, and he set me down, and he was really mean. All of a sudden, he was mean. Like he said, you have to get a sponsor, and you have to go to AA, and you have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I'm like, I'm going to get a divorce. And he's like, no, you're not going to do anything for the first year. You're just going to focus on your sobriety. And so I called the Smith family reunion and told them, you know, I'm going to go to AA and we can call off the intervention. So I started going to AA. And I went to High Noon, which if you're from San Francisco, it's like it's a pretty raucous meeting. There's like tattoos and motorcycles and me. And but there's a lot of sobriety in that room. And the time worked for me. So I'm sitting there, and this guy comes in, and he goes, I've just gotten out of jail, and I'm so grateful, and I'm going to start AA, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there thinking, God, jail? And the next week, I was in jail. Because I took my kids up to Nevada to go skiing and to meet my friend who lives in Carson City. And I'd sat in AA for 3 weeks, and I heard that we are not saints. And I knew that that was code for we drank a little bit. So that's what I did. There that car went off the road to get some more vodka in the morning. And I took those three kids and my friend's daughter, because my friend was working, we went up the mountain to go skiing. And later, my friend's daughter said to my daughter, does your mom always stop on the side of the road and go to the bathroom on the way up skiing? Which I don't remember, but I don't remember much of that day. But we went up there, and I didn't ski. I really don't know what I did. I know I drank all day, and I put the little one in the babysitting, and the other three, they went skiing all day. And Darcy, my friend's daughter, called her mom, and she said, Sydney's drunk, and you got to come get us. And to this day, they are still like so apologetic about that. I'm like, are you kidding? That was the smartest thing you could have done. So here comes Kay up there. It's about a 30-minute drive from Carson to Incline Village. She's all mean too. She's like, I'm taking the kids, and by this time, of course, I've lost the keys to the car. And I don't care, and goodbye. And it's starting to get dark, and it's pretty cold, and I don't have the keys to the car. And she's gone with the kids. And apparently I did find the keys, and I drove for 8 hours down that mountain, and it's a 30-minute drive. I've since driven that many times. It's scary in the daytime, and it's dark, and I must have been stopping to drink along the way. But at some point, 8 hours later, I made it to Carson City, God knows how. And I pulled off, and I turned the keys off, and I passed out. And the next thing I know, you know how the police have those giant flashlights, and it's like in my face, and these are rapping on the door. And well, I got the blue Volvo station wagon, the blue Volvo station wagon that's now the total blue Volvo station wagon. I'm sitting in that car with my ski outfit on, and he thinks my car is just like, something's happened to my car. And then he looks at me and he's like, you're drunk. And I had to do that field sobriety test, and that lasted about 2 seconds, because I'm like, I'm drunk. And I started talking to him, and apparently at some point it occurred to me, as a lawyer, I should stop talking. And later my lawyer said, I could tell when that light flashed on. But you know what? I'm glad this happened. I am glad this happened. So I went to jail, and my friend couldn't find me, and she was calling everybody, and my kids, everybody was terribly worried about what happened to me and where I was. And to put them through that, it's awful. It's awful. And so I called my mother, and I said, Mom, I've been arrested. And she goes, we don't get arrested. And I'm like, well, apparently we do. And then, you know, people like to say, oh, I wish I had a picture of what I looked at like before and after, because, you know, we do clean up pretty good. And I'm like, oh, I do. It's a mugshot. And you ought to see this thing. When I had to do my community service, the mugshot is embedded in that piece of paper, the community service, and I took it to my friend. Part of the community service was working at my church, and so I took it to the head deacon, who's my friend, this old man, and he's like, good God, you look like Eileen Warmus in that picture. Now, I don't know if you remember who Eileen Warmus was, but she was a prostitute serial killer who was executed in Florida about 15 years ago. So then I do come to AA, and I go to a meeting every day, but I don't get a sponsor because I am looking for the perfect sponsor. And we all know what the perfect sponsor is. It's a person that can take you through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't get a sponsor, and later when a friend had a one-year party for me, all my new friends were like, we didn't think you were going to make it. Because I didn't get a sponsor, also because I had things to do. Because at 4 months, that long-suffering husband gave me divorce papers. And that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. But it was also, and it was a necessary and a good thing, but it was really hard. I was 4 months sober. Now I had these three kids, and I hadn't worked in a number of years, and it was a really, really hard time. And at 6 months, I had the DUI trial, because I just didn't think that was really fair that I was arrested for DUI when the car was parked. But it's called actual physical control, and there is a statute and case law about that. But so I went to court, and I hired my friend's brother, who I had also grown up with, Lee, and Lee taught me how to dance when I was about in seventh grade. Now, Lee was the DUI lawyer in Nevada. So, you know, you go into court, and we don't sit in the defendant's seat. We sit in the lawyer's seat, and let me tell you, that was a humbling experience. And I recycle, you know, I hadn't lost all my morals and values, so I had all these bottles in the back of the car, so they had taken pictures of it, and you go into the court, and they're all, like, blown up on all this, you know, it wasn't even a jury trial, bottles and bottles, and it was surreal, it was just surreal to sit there and watch this thing unfold. And at one point, Lee takes me out in the hall, And he's like, not going so well. And I'm like, let's just plead it, no contest. And he goes, you know what, though, legally, we have not all the judges are even lawyers. And he's like, we have a good case, but it's up to you. And I thought about it, and I thought, I do not want to be known as the Sidney Holler seminal case of DUI in Nevada. I don't want anybody citing to my name as the case, and you know, that pride and ego. But so I'm like, you know, and the other thing really more importantly was it was over. I mean, I was drunk. And so I pled no contest. And then I was looking at jail time, and the best I was looking at was the ankle bracelet. I was terrified. And that judge, I had a letter from the deacon and also a letter from somebody from AA. And he held up those letters and he said, you know, I'm going to sentence you to community service and a fine and DUI school and victim impact statement school, and I'm not going to give you any time. It really was, to me, like one of the first miracles of this program, because I deserved whatever he was going to give me, I deserved. So this is kind of an interesting story, though. So about 6 months ago, I'm in Carson City, Nevada, and I'm standing in front of the court getting ready to go see a client on a case I'd been appointed to by that same judge. And I called my sponsor and I said, this is unbelievable that he appointed me to this case. And it was a death penalty case, and I was the mitigation specialist. And, you know, how, you can't make this stuff up. And so, but somebody said, well, do you think he really remembered you? And I said, well, he probably wouldn't have remembered me, because by then it had been 9 years. But in December, I had applied to be a duty judge, which is you review warrants for probable cause and do bail hearings and help the Superior Court. And so I had an interview, and I was really excited to have this interview. And it's the morning of the interview. The interview's at 5:30 at night. At 8 o'clock, I get a call from the human services person, and she's like, I want to talk to you about this sensitive topic. And I go, yeah, I put that I had been convicted of a misdemeanor DUI and that, you know, blah, blah, blah. She goes, no, we really appreciate your honesty, but I just want to let you know that there's a warrant out for your arrest. And I said, no. I did that. I paid the fine. I did the community service. She said, well, I don't know. One of the judges Googled Sidney Holler DUI Carson City, and there is a warrant out for your arrest. So I think you should get this cleared up before you come in for the interview with the Superior Court judges. So I call my friends in Carson City. They're both lawyers. And I said, can you go get this, you know, get this straightened out for me. So Bob, the husband, he goes down to the sheriff's office, and they pull it up, and they go, yeah, there is a warrant out for her arrest because I had done the DUI school. No, I had done the community service and the fine. I had not done the DUI school or the victim impact statement. And so he's like, what should she do? And they said, well, she should turn herself in today. And I'm like, oh, I think that's a bad idea. So I got online and signed up for those, because 9 years ago they weren't online, and signed up for them. And, you know, you don't just whip them out. They're both, I think, about 8 hours each. And then Bob said, well, I'll go get the judge and I'll tell him what you're doing so he can quash the warrant. And but the judge's house had been shot up by some defendants the night before, so he wasn't available to help me out. So you can only imagine what it was like to go into that interview and say, yes, there is a warrant out for my arrest. I mean, what a humbling experience that was. And then I'm like, and here's what I'm doing, and okay, now we can start the interview. And I didn't get the job, and so I was sure that that's what it was. But then later I found out that they had, because of the budget cuts, they had let go of all these commissioners, and it was just kind of a sham interview anyway to rehire the commissioners, which made me feel a lot better. So. So now I've lost my train of thought. So what it's like now. When I first came to AA, I was amazed at this program. I mean, What amazed me was like there was no judgment. I came into the other bar after I'd gotten that DUI, and I was, you know, mortified. And I told them, and they're like, one DUI? That's it? Please. And I told my mom that, and she's like, that's what they said. There's no judgment, and the idea of no crosstalk. When do you ever go to a meeting where there's no crosstalk, where a person can say their piece and nobody's telling them that you're wrong or that's stupid or here's how you should run your life. And all people want to do is help you stop drinking and help you learn how to live a life, a sober life. And it really kind of stunned me. And then the stories. I love the stories. When I was new, I really loved the stories. I mean, I really related to the stories. The rest of it, what it's like now, I couldn't really get a handle on that. But the stories really gripped me, and they brought me in and kept me coming back. I will say that those insipid sayings drove me nuts, that one day at a time, just for today, one foot in front of the other, do the next right thing, and that serenity prayer, oh my God, it reminded me of on Saturday Night Live when Stuart Smalley used to do those affirmations, when he'd look in the mirror and he'd say, I am good enough. I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people love me. And you know what? Now I embrace those sayings. They mean so much to me, and I think the serenity prayer, I say the serenity prayer every day. It's just funny to look back on the bright ideas that I had when I came in, and maybe it's a good idea to listen to how things are going here in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of my own ideas. So what I do is I have a number of sponsees, and I go to the San Francisco jail. I'm on the board of the other bar, the statewide board. And I try to be of service. I try, when somebody says, do you want to sponsor me? Do you want to speak at a meeting? Do you want a commitment? That's what I try and do, and I think that's what the importance of this program is. I wanted to talk a little bit about the steps. And when I heard step one, we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable, that one was such a comfort to me because I thought I was a bad person, I was weak, I needed more willpower, there was just something wrong with me. And when I found out I'm powerless over alcohol, it was like, this isn't my fault. This is what I am. I'm an alcoholic and there's something I can do about it. The second step came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. When I came to AA, people would say I was insane, and then I came to AA, and now I'm not insane. And I was sitting there going, I didn't feel insane. I needed to stop drinking, but I didn't feel insane. And somebody explained to me, really, the insanity is that thinking that I can drink again. And, you know, when they talk about the guy that puts a little whiskey in his milk or the jaywalker, that's the insanity. And a power greater than myself, because it certainly isn't me, can stop me from doing that. Because, the obsession has lifted. And I was talking about this with a friend here last night. I don't have the obsession. I'm not thinking about it and doing it all the time. But it does. There's thoughts that come in. That's, that might be a good idea. And it comes out of nowhere. I was at an event with my school. Oh, this was several years ago. And it was one of those nice, hot, sunny days in San Francisco. And it was this beautiful Victorian and all these fancy people. And I didn't know any of them, and I walk in, and they're serving wine, and the guy comes up, and, the hand goes out, and I'm like, whoa, no, I don't drink. But that is the insanity of thinking that, but we can stop. I didn't have to act on it. The third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. Well, I heard that, and I thought, geez, I need more willpower. I need to get off that couch and quit drinking vodka. I didn't understand this willpower. And somebody said to me, no, it's action. You need to take action. It's not the willpower, it's the action. And I heard recently a man in AA say he viewed it as an invitation to let go of his attachments. And I like that. My sponsor says God's will is to be of service. That's her definition of what's God's will. Once I was at... When I was new, I thought, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. God's will, my will. So as the topic, I chose this brilliant topic of where's the line? where do you stop? You do your work, and then you stop and let God do God's work. And she's, and somebody out in the audience, which you never hear, corrected me. And she's like, that's not the way it works. It's hand in hand the whole time. And I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. But I struggle with it. I struggle with it. And I chair a third step meeting right now. A couple of years ago, I decided I wanted to be a public defender. And so I'm like, I'm going to be a public defender. I mean, I've done a lot of court appearances. I know my way around the court. The clients don't scare me. And, you know, I got these letters of recommendation. And there's a lot of Bay Area counties. And this was not working. And so I just would try harder and get more letters and get more people to call. And people inside the offices were telling me, it's age. And I'm like, I'm not my mother's age. But they said they hire people that are straight out of law school or that have a significant amount of criminal experience. They don't want you. And I'm like, and it took the longest time. And I thought, you know what? There's nothing, you can beat your head against the wall, but you need to just accept that that's not where this is going. I tell the story of, I used to do public policy for the juvenile court system and involved all these meetings with the lawyers and we worked in teams, so lawyers and social workers. And so, you know how, like, we'd have these long meetings. And my boss would sit there and, like, he was so zen about the whole thing. So I thought, I'm going to ask him, how do you do this, Chris? And he goes, Sydney, we're different. Lawyers like to, here's the problem, get a solution, let's get it done. Social workers like to process and collaborate and coordinate and talk. And he goes, just sit back and enjoy the show. What are you going to do about it? Don't they teach you that in those meetings you go to? The fourth step, the resentments. I loved writing down those resentments. I had pages and pages and pages, but my part column, that was news to me. And I guess it says something like that in the book, that, you know, our resentments were about as far as we ever got with that. And that was really an interesting process, to write down the resentments and what it was and what it affect my part. And I had trouble with some of them, and a lot of them were just acceptance. That my part was, you just need to accept it. And when I got a divorce, I really resented my dad, because I got this divorce, and it was really hard, and he had time, and he didn't come out to see me and help me and take care of things. I resent my dad. It affects my part. You know, over time, I was like, you know what, your part is acceptance. I love my dad. We have a really close relationship. You know, maybe that's not his thing. He doesn't owe you coming to help you and take care of the kids. And acceptance. So I was good with that until years later. And I was running a conference, which actually was in this same hotel, which is really funny to be back down here. And it was this 1,000-person conference with the judges and lawyers and all this stuff. And I needed somebody to come help me take care of the kids for the 4 days I was going to be gone. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to call him. I'm just going to ask him. And it's okay. So I call him, and he said to me, this makes me cry. He goes, Sydney, I've been waiting a long time for this call. I didn't want to bug you. I didn't want to force my way into your life. I was just waiting for you to call and ask me. I would be thrilled to come out and help you with your kids. And it said to me, what else is in that fourth column where it's just, I put acceptance, where really there was some action that I could have taken on my part to change things. So the fifth step, after I read my fourth step to my sponsor, I didn't get that sense of relief and that people all talk about in the world, everything was lifted. But I did go home. I read it to her in two parts. And the first time I went home and threw up the entire afternoon. And the second time I slept the entire afternoon. So I think there is some kind of catharsis that goes on. And I love listening to them. I love listening to the women I sponsor, their four steps. And what's interesting, and my sponsor pointed out to me on that my part, is there was so much of judgment and expectation. Judgment, and you know, you see a pattern that I didn't even know was there. And I still, my kids call me judgy to this day. But it's really enlightening to see that pattern and to have somebody point it out to you. So 6 and 7, the character defects. A friend of mine in AA, what he does is he prays for the opposite of his character defects, to have more of them come in. And I really like that. And you know, over time that it's gotten really lengthy, that what I pray for. But I pray for love and tolerance, patience, perseverance, serenity, surrender, strength, humor, humility, honesty, intrigue, curiosity, willingness, joy, optimism, acceptance, and gratitude. I'm sure there's some more. But I was telling my son that I pray for, you know, we were talking about optimism, and I said, oh yeah, I've just added that, I pray for optimism. He goes, why do you pray for it? Why don't you just be optimistic? And I thought, that's a good way, just be. And then 8 and 9, the idea of the amends, the idea of living amends had never occurred to me. And I think that's an amazing concept, of living amends. Because the people I did the most harm to were my children. And, you know, what am I going to say to them? I was drunk and I'm changing my ways, and do you have anything you want to say about that? I mean, words are just not, it's not quite as meaningful, I think, when they're children. And the idea of living amends and to show them that I've changed. And when two of them were in college in New York at the same time, and they would both flew out of JFK on the same day at different times, okay, I'll come and get you at the airport at 11 at night and 1 in the morning. But I will say, you know, I thought I had done all my amends, and I was in the hospital. My dad got really sick, and he was in the hospital in St. Louis, and he's been married to this woman that was not on my amends list, even though we had probably not spoken in 34 years. More like Cold War. I had never done anything to her. I was pleasant, you know, that was his wife. And so we're in the hospital, and she corners me, and she says to me, and we'd never had words or anything, and she said to me, there's you kids, my siblings and I, you just fly in here and don't you even have the decency to, like, let me know that you're coming to the hospital, and sort of really lets me have it. And I'm telling you, because of this program, I sat there and I said, you know what, Jackie, you're right. How rude is that of me to come in here? That's what I always tell my kids, just tell me, and usually the answer is yes. Then she opened up the whole 34 years, and I could have said, and you did this, and my dad did this, and I didn't even want to. I said, yeah, I was wrong, and that was wrong, and I know my dad loves you very much, and what a waste of time. And I mean, it was, and all the animosity, and we're hugging and crying, and the nurses are kind of squeezing by, and all the animosity was gone. And I had no intention of ever making amends. It didn't occur to me to make amends to her. And we're friends now, and we talk, and we email, and it made me think, who else is out there that I need to make amends to that I think I don't even owe an amends to? And my dad, the next day, he's like, thank you for doing that. Could you talk to your siblings and see if they would, because none of us had anything to do with her. And so I flew it up the flagpole. They're not alcoholics. And they're like, no, we don't think so. And the 10th step, continue to make amends as they come up. I was thinking about this, and the first, like, really big one, well, it wasn't big, but it was in this hotel. And so I'm running this conference, and there's all these workshops, and you have to go from workshop to workshop and meet the speakers and make sure it's kind of going okay. So I'm standing there, and there are these voluminous rooms. There's hundreds of people in each one. And one of the monitors who worked in our office, and she was new in our office, an attorney, came up to me, and she goes, Sydney, I have to ask you to move. I'm thinking, don't you know who I am? And what I said to her is, I'll stand where I want to stand. And as soon as I said that, I'm like, God. And so she's like, okay, and moves away. And you know how you have that feeling in the pit of your stomach the second that you say or do something that's wrong? And I was like, whoa. So a couple hours later, I saw her, and I'm like, Ann, I can't believe I said that. That was so rude and wrong, and that was just, it was bad of me to say that. And she said to me, oh, well, the fire marshals had been coming around, and I thought you were testing me to see if I'd force you out of the way of the room because you were blocking the exit. But, you know, I say that because you... Now we're friends, and if I hadn't done that, I would have avoided her, and I would have felt bad, and it would just have festered for, you know, forever. The 11th step, asking for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out, I say that prayer a lot, often, during the day. I think it's really powerful. A few years ago, my son is now a senior in college, but he was looking at colleges, and he's really super outdoorsy, so we were looking in Colorado, and Oregon, and Maine, and all these places, and he said to me, how do you pick? How do you decide where you're going to go to college? And I said, I don't know, Logan. In AA, they say, we ask for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out, and he's like, whoa. Where'd you go all religious on me? And I'm like, you've only gone to church every Sunday of your life. But then I decided, you know, that's a good idea for me. And I don't think I asked for God's the knowledge of God's will, and God says, here's the answer. I don't know what happens, but I think it opens up my mind just to consider something else besides what I think is a good idea. And so I said to him, you know, I've been thinking about that, Logan, and I really want you to go to school at Bowdoin in Maine, but it seems like you want to go to school in Colorado and at Colorado College, and, you know, you should go where you want to go. And he's like, great. I'll tell the college counselor that Jesus says I'm going to school in Colorado. And he ended up at school in New York. In the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we continued to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers and practice these principles in all our affairs. And my sponsor, her thing is humility and service. Humility and service. That's the answer to everything. And I would add faith to that. So about two years ago, around, my life just fell apart. Everything at once, and it was what somebody referred to as drinkable moments. And it started in April, and we had the family home, and we had agreed that we would sell it when Logan went, the middle child, went to college, and so he was in college, and it was time to sell it. Okay, you know, okay, I didn't want to, but okay. And so we put it on the market, and this is not San Francisco today. This was San Francisco 2 years ago, where the housing, things were not moving. And so we kept lowering the price of our house, and my agent kept saying, you should buy it. And I'm like, I can't buy it. And we kept lowering it and lowering it. And finally it got to the point where I'm like, oh, maybe I can buy it. And so we also had an offer at that point. And so all of a sudden, so I'm ready to buy my former husband out of the house. And that lawyer, his lawyer, by then I can't afford a lawyer anymore, so I represent myself. And he files this ex parte application for an order shortening time, so I get this notice of a motion, and it's in 2 days. And they're going in, I can't remember what it's called. I have learned a lot of law representing myself, but I can't remember the real estate term. But anyway, it's to force the sale of the house. And to the third party. And so we go in there, and we go in there twice, and I'm like, I'm offering him more money, but whatever. And I did prevail on that, thank God. And the lawyer, his lawyer said, you know, Sydney, I'm really glad that you won. And I'm like, thank you. You're a lot of help. I said, Barry, you know, there's a certain amount of professional courtesy, even if you're opposing. And this guy was a really decent guy. He worked hard for his client, but he was a decent guy. And I said to him, Barry, I hope I don't ever see you again. No offense. And he goes, Sydney, I'm sure we will be seeing each other. So, and then in May, I had been seeing this man for NAA for like 6.5 years, and we were in love. We talked about spending the rest of our lives together. It was just really an amazing relationship. And I thought we were going to talk about getting married or moving in, but he said, it's over. There was no other woman. Nothing had happened. I mean, it was like, just over. And I was devastated. I was like, I was devastated. It was, it just, it took a part of my heart away. And then a couple of months after that, I go into my job, and I was working for the state of California, and the budget situation was bad, so nobody was ever getting any raises at that time. So my bosses call me in, and I thought they were calling me to tell me what a great job I was doing, because we'd been doing all this juvenile competency work and all this privacy and it around the state with the judges and lawyers, and things were going great. And they called me in to tell me that I was always on a grant-funded, yearly grant-funded position, and it was always renewed. It was not a big deal. That there was no more grant, and that I was going to be losing my job in 2 months. And I'm like, what? I mean, it was just like, wow, that was really, really out of the blue. And all along, my dad was there for me. I mean, I would call him, and he would call me, and he helped me with the house. And he's like, you know, sometimes you have these people in your lives that are really sort of wise, and they have great advice, and but there's no judgment. You can take it or leave it. Here's what I'm thinking you might want to do. But so I could just really talk to him, and he's like, I'll be out there. Whatever you need, I'm here for you. And so I'm talking to him on the phone, and he's like, hold on just a minute. And he was in the doctor's office, and he goes, oh, the doctor said, Charlie, you look gray. We ran some tests, and you need to go to the emergency room right now. And he goes, so I got to go. And I said, oh, Dad, my bad luck is rubbing off on you. Hang up. And we laughed, and then a week later, he was diagnosed with leukemia. And he didn't want to tell me. He's like, I could tell there was something going on, and he just didn't want to tell me. And he goes, you have too many things going on with the house and Larry and your job. I don't want to bother you. And I'm like, Dad, I'll get another job and maybe another man, whatever. But there's only one Dad, and then he died. Shortly thereafter, and it was really just unbelievable. He was on some kind of experimental. He was supposed to prolong his life for 5 years, and it just didn't work. And I was able to go to the hospital and spend a week with him, and in St. Louis. And at one point, he wasn't in pain, so he wasn't on pain pills, but he just was really weak. And he said, Sydney, why don't you talk, and I'll listen. And so I was, chattering away. And he goes, I want to hear about, tell me more about AA. Because he loved this program. And our book says we get to see newcomers change and grow, but so do they. And so I would call my sponsor throughout this whole, all this stuff. And I would call her, crying, and what do I do? And she's like, this is going to be really great. Your experience, strength, and hope will help a newcomer. And I'd call her again, and she goes, This is good for the newcomer. I'm like, what? The newcomer? What about me? It's like a friend of mine in AA, he says, he had a hard time with God because, why do bad things happen to good people? And he said, what I really mean is, why do bad things happen to me? And throughout this whole process, all the well-intentioned people would say, God's will, God has a better plan for you. Another one door shuts, another one opens, and I'm like, this is really not helpful. And but somebody said, but the hallways are a bitch. But what I felt was God's presence with me. It was like, God didn't create this. God isn't like, okay, we're going to see how much. Oh, yeah, God doesn't give you more than you can handle. I just don't believe that. I think just things happen. Life happens, and this happened to all happen at once. But I felt the presence of God just with me as I went through this. And that sponsor, I was like, "Urgh." And then she'd say, I think you're growing spiritually. But really what she said is true. I mean, that is this program. It's one alcoholic helping another. And when I heard these stories, I'd say, I'd drink over one of those. And just sharing what we go through and seeing what people go through and that they go through it and they don't drink, and rather than somebody from on high telling us, here's how you're going to do it, some expert, it's how this program works. And I've had I've had a number of women tell me that. Like there was one I sat next to recently, and she said she was getting a divorce. I'm like, oh, you know, I didn't know. I'm really sorry. You should have called me. And she goes, you know, you've helped me a lot. And I'm like, how did I help you? And she goes, just watching you go through this stuff. And so, you know, that whole bear witness, you don't know what the actions that you're taking, the effect that they might have on somebody else. So I want to talk a little bit about the importance of service. So when I came into AA, I'd hear that, and I'm like, aha, no. I'm not going to be a patsy. You know, people will take advantage of you if you let them. You know, if you do too much for somebody, and I don't, you know, you got to have boundaries. And I don't know where this came from, because I come from a family of service. My parents, that's what they were all about, and I grew up in the church, and that's what the church was all about. But that was my idea, which is just wrong. I mean, that's what we do. That's what we do, is one alcoholic working with another alcoholic. My son Logan rode his bicycle across the country a year and a half ago. And I'm telling you, the goodness and kindness of people in Canada and the United States was astounding to me. And what he said was, people would say over and over, pay it forward. And that's what I think this program is. It's our obligation to pay it forward. And I tell the women that I work with, they're like, oh, we can't believe you're spending so much time with us, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you know, I like working with you, but even if I didn't, it's what we do, and it's what you're going to do too. It's just how this thing works. And the last thing I want to say is, I don't know if there's any newcomers here today. If there are, I think you're really courageous to come to a convention, because when I was new, I would like shoot in the back door, sit in the back in that, what do they call it, the half measures row, and listen to the meeting. I would listen very intently and then like try and avoid those women that would thrust their cards on me and would try to be so nice for like the first year. But what I want to say is what I heard when I was new, which really meant a lot to me, was, we shall not regret the past, nor will we shut the door on it. Because I was just ashamed and mortified, and I felt horrible when I came in. And I love that promises, because yeah, what I did was wrong, but you got to remember the past. Don't forget the past, but don't dwell on it. Move forward from it. And the other thing is, today, you know, you come in and you're like, how can I not drink the rest of my life? How can I attend my child's wedding without drinking, or the graduation? I'm thinking, well, that was kind of funny, because I mean, I just drank all day long. I didn't need a reason. It was just, but I like that today. Can you not drink today? Go to a meeting, talk to somebody, watch a lot of Law and Order at the end of the night, reruns, and yeah, today I can do it. Today, if I don't think about, you know, the rest of my life, I can do it for today. I think this program is a program of hope, and that's what, it's just a program of hope. And I look around, and I love it when people say this, we're in a room full of miracles. I mean, it really is, it's a miracle. God's grace and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful to Bill and Bob for what they created, this program. And the last thing I want to say is what my sponsor always likes to remind me is, just remember, your primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic. Thank you.